Good evening, everyone. This is my Way Seeking Mind talk. Maybe some of you don't know what that is. I'll keep talking till we get the sound right. That's all it is. I'm just talking. And it is really nice to be here again in this room. Thank you, Greg. With the ocean and its ceaseless waves of sound and mind. I have a memory from last year being here in this room for the first time. And before I got settled into Zazen, the sound outside took me right back inside to some of my favorite memories from childhood. Being at the ocean with my whole family on the North Carolina shore. We rented the same dilapidated little cottage called the Webb Tide for the same 2 weeks in June every summer. And the cottage had a wraparound screened-in porch and a beat-up outdoor shower facing the ocean. It was heaven. Piles of books, long days playing in the surf, with my two brothers and sister, playing cards with my whole family, and always the soothing call of the Atlantic. All that beauty, and at the same time, I also remember the pain of watching fish gasp and croak for air in a shallow bucket of water as my father surf-casted with a long fishing rod from the beach. I remember the way a frightened crab backed away from the boiling water that had consumed his companions, only to be grabbed by my mother and thrown into the pot. My 7-year-old self was horrified by the way these animals died. But by that time, I had decided that death was something to keep to myself. No one really wanted to talk about it. Keep it to myself, the self. I look back now and I see my little self forming so early and in such isolation. It amazes me that I found my way to Buddhist practice at all. All these causes and conditions that have blessed us. Here's another thing I remember, maybe one of my strongest memories from childhood. Burnished for so many reasons over the many years that perhaps it's totally unreliable. Nonetheless, I'm 5 years old, sitting with a paper Dixie cup of water in my darkened bedroom. Tears are streaming down my cheeks, a heaving set of hiccups jostling my small frame. For whatever reason, this particular night, it has become terrifyingly clear to me that everyone will die. Most of all my parents, but everyone I love, everyone I have yet to meet. I am inconsolable, and my poor, exhausted parents tell me that this thing called death will not come for a long time. And then they leave the room. So begins my way-seeking mind, or at least the version of the story that is arising tonight. My small self was hatched that night when I was 5 years old, gripped with an unconsolable grief about the idea of death. The year is 1969, and that same year, 3,000 miles away to the west of my shadowy bedroom in Pittsburgh, maybe on that very same night, Suzuki Roshi is sitting in San Francisco and telling his students, "You should not rely on some teaching, but you should reflect on yourself, polish yourself, and as much as you can, get rid of selfish ideas." As a child, without anyone to process my fear of death, I began building my own container of self to shield me from this dark secret. At the same time, and really amazingly to me, I was also probing that container of self for weaknesses. Despite my upset that night when I was 5, I remember lying awake on many childhood nights, marveling at the way my own patterns of thinking worked. I would lie in the dark, staring at the ceiling, and would begin to work backward from my last thought. What was the thought I had just before this one? I could see the long train of connected thoughts lining up like boxcars on the tracks below our neighborhood. I was thinking about a hat because I remember my mother was wearing one at the annual Easter flower show. And before hat, I was thinking about flowers because the crocus had just pushed their heads up through the April snow. And before crocus and snow, I was thinking about the word crocus because someone had asked me at dinner how to spell it. And before the spelling question, I was thinking about dinner because I could feel my stomach turn. And on and on and on. Each night I marveled at this never-ending stream of thoughts. Here comes another one and another, like the train cars. But I could travel back through them, reversing them, like counting backwards from 1,000. I remember using this technique to unthink myself to sleep. My wonderful parents were both born in 1937. They met in college and married shortly after graduating. My mother earned a master's degree in social work, and she went on to champion the needs of underserved young mothers in Pittsburgh. She helped to refurbish buildings actually owned by the Catholic Diocese into supportive housing and affordable housing. My father went to work for U.S. Steel, and like his father, kept that job until he retired. By the time my parents started having kids in their early 20s, the country seemed to be in upheaval. My mother was 5 months pregnant with me when President Kennedy was shot in the head and killed. As a kid, I remember watching Walter Cronkite on the evening news and seeing the bodies of young soldiers carried on stretchers from the jungles of Vietnam. By the time my parents had their fourth child in the summer of 1969, my mother, who loves books and science and politics, she had slipped into a postpartum depression. I was 5 years old and pretty much left to cope on my own. Not so bad. It was a parenting style that has its benefits. But when my mother emerged from her depression a year or so later, I had developed a particular way of being in the world that I hoped would ease her pain. I tried to be good, to not need anything, and to not ask for anything. When something troubling did occur, I assumed it was my problem to take care of, whether it was the dead catfish resting belly up in the fish tank, or the strange unwanted touching from an older relative, or the angry spankings from overly stressed parents. I retreated from a world I did not find particularly trustworthy. And I'm going to pause now and just breathe. I hope you'll breathe with me. Thank you. Instead, I turned to the more reliable contours of my own mind. I would figure things out by myself. But what was this self? Fortunately, I had siblings to keep me from taking myself too seriously. When we returned from our 2 weeks in North Carolina each June, summer and the Pennsylvania woods stretched like an endless green promise in front of us. In those days, there were tons of kids nearby, and every evening after dinner, we gathered like a noisy roost of tropical birds at the center of our tree-filled neighborhood to play games of release or kick the can. One evening, during an extended game of release, essentially a game of team hide and seek, that covered several blocks in our neighborhood. I found the perfect hiding spot. I crouched in a thicket of bushes and waited for someone to come find me. And I waited. Finally, my brothers came looking for me and let me know that the game had ended over an hour ago. But in my hiding, I had discovered something else. The whole world of insects and birds and light that was changing right in front of me. The quieter I got, the more I saw and heard. Nature was such a central part of my childhood that to this day, my siblings and I continue to meet up for canoeing and hiking trips together. I remember lying in the side yard, listening to the cicadas, or watching lightning bugs, or lingering in the woods to listen to the sound of trees creaking overhead. All this comforted me in a way I couldn't explain. And I know many of us, if not all of us in this room, have had this experience. Even as I tried to understand how death fit into all of this, I had a sense that there was something much larger and more mysterious about the world than that small room I had constructed inside my head at night. Sometimes I caught glimpses of this at Catholic Church. The incense, the rituals, the absolute kindness of Jesus. But my father was not a churchgoer, and my mother had become deeply ambivalent about the Catholic Church and the way it treated women. She had loved Catholic school as a girl, and I know it was hard for her to turn completely away from her faith. But she was more educated than her own mother and more excited by the promise of science and feminism than she could imagine that the She was more excited than she could imagine that the Catholic Church would ever allow. Nonetheless, I am grateful that she took us to Sunday Mass every week and made sure we were all confirmed before she let us go on our various teenage ways. One day, I was sitting in my seventh grade social studies class with our teacher, Mrs. Stack. We used to call her Smokestack, because she was perpetually surrounded by the smell of cigarettes. She was one of these hardened Pittsburgh public school teachers who had seen a lot and did not put up with much. I wasn't particularly inspired by her teaching, but on this day, after breezing through a lesson on world religions, Mrs. Stack paused in the middle of a coughing fit and told us to put our hands on our desktops and to get comfortable. "Put your feet on the floor and close your eyes," she guffed. We thought she was nuts, but everyone complied. She proceeded to walk us through a guided meditation, which involved falling through layers of color in our minds. When I opened my eyes, it was still 1977, but I was stunned. It was the first time someone outside my mind had guided me through my mind. I did not think that was possible. "That's called meditation," she barked. "It's a Hindu thing. Class over." She headed down the hall to the smoke-filled teacher's lounge. I didn't think about my initial meditation instruction much again, but I kept connecting with the natural world, and like my older brother and my younger brother, took a keen interest in camping and backpacking. I was a Girl Scout, and my mother, in an effort to connect with me, became an assistant troop leader, which gave us the opportunity to go camping together. Eventually, I majored in environmental studies when I went away to college. I also wanted to write and was all involved in all kinds of art and theater productions, but I set most of that aside to find a job working in the environment once I graduated. Growing up in Pittsburgh in the 70s and 80s, I knew not only the wonders of the natural world, but also the abuse it was suffering at the hands of the same industry that employed my father. But in 1986, when I graduated from college, U.S. Steel was in dramatic decline, laying off tens of thousands of steelworkers. The year I graduated, the industry had effectively collapsed, and my dad was lucky to still have his job selling steel and sheet metal products. I think it was something about his kindness and subtle sense of humor that enabled him to survive and still put four kids through college. I knew there was no future for me in Pittsburgh, And I had already set my eyes on California, where my boyfriend and I planned to move in with some friends from high school. We arrived on New Year's Eve in 1987 and lived in a group houses, first in San Francisco and then in West Marin. I started working for the League of Conservation Voters, a group that was dedicated to electing environmental leaders to public office. And from there, my career took off. I worked on communications and project management for a number of regional and national conservation groups, taking a particular interest in habitat restoration. My boyfriend at the time was a little less enchanted with San Francisco than I was, but the whole household bonded over weekend trips to the Sierra Nevada high country. Every other weekend, we were on some kind of backpacking excursion in the mountains, climbing peaks, scrambling over boulder fields, and traveling cross-country through high mountain meadows and passes. And although I personally never did a lot of technical climbing, we often quoted from Stephen Roper's Guide to Climbing the Sierra Nevada. His enthusiastic prose created aphorisms for living. It's an easy scramble to the summit, attain the ridge, and class two from any direction. When we weren't challenging ourselves with Roper's insistence that every peak could be climbed, we were quoting Han Shan and his Cold Mountain poems. Here's one that was in heavy rotation. Once I moved to Cold Mountain, everything was at rest. No more useless, mixed up thinking. In idleness, I write my poems on stone walls, accepting whatever happens like an untied boat. My older housemate, Matt, he was probably like 28 at the time, considered himself a devotee of the poet and all things Zen, although he had little formal experience with practice. The poems in that little book seemed to touch something so real about being in the mountains, the simplicity and openness of being. But I also had the feeling that these texts and the way they were treated by my mostly male hiking companions were not quite the whole story. The boys, for they really were still boys at the time, seemed to be catching the last vapors of the Dharma bums without much thought to the deeper implications of what they were reading. In other words, we broke a lot of precepts during those years. I had no experience with formal Buddhist teaching either, but I was intrigued that this poet of our High Sierra adventures was connected to a larger lineage. One night, I was on a business trip in Los Angeles to help plan a fundraiser for an environmental candidate. We never had a travel budget, so a colleague put me up for the night in his boyfriend's painting studio. Ian's loft was crammed with antiques and lots of half-finished figurative paintings. I could tell he was trying to say something beyond words in each of these portraits that I spent the night with, and it piqued my interest in painting. It was the first real studio I had ever been in. But I mostly remember that night because I sat up late reading Returning to Silence by Katagiri Roshi, a book I had borrowed from my housemate, a book I apparently never returned because I found it on our bookshelves when I was preparing for this talk. Inside was my faded environmental press pass from over 35 years ago, still bookmarking a page, which read, "There are three kinds of thirsting desire. The first is to please oneself continuously. This desire arises from our deep fear of the transiency of life." The deep fear of the transiency of life. I was knocked back to my childhood fears of death and dying. Here was someone naming what I knew to be true and talking about it in a way I had never heard before. Still, the Zen liturgy, even in Katagiri Roshi's accessible writing, did not penetrate. I left the book on the shelf and headed for the mountains. In the early 90s, I left my job and traveled to Nepal with a new boyfriend. We embarked on a 200-mile trek in the Everest region with three other friends. Walking every day for over a month, we made our way from Kathmandu in a winding arc, climbing over 18,000-foot passes and peaks, and spending long days on glaciers above treeline. We continued our long walk east toward the tropical Rai River Valley near the Indian border. The entire time, we were guided by a young Sherpa named Jhumpa. He was good-natured and had cherry cheeks and was clearly capable of managing a trip of this length. To appease his family, he had lived in a Buddhist monastery as a monk before switching to the booming trade in guiding Westerners through the Himalaya. We camped in different monastery courtyards along the way, and I still remember the flip-flap of the monk's sandals smacking the mud just outside our tent as they walked in early morning darkness to the meditation hall. I'd left Katagiri Roshi's book on my shelf at home, but here I was with Jhumpa, a real life, albeit former monk. I could walk with him for days through the mountains and talk about Buddhism. Jhumpa was game, but only up to a point. He was working to make sure everyone made it through the trip alive. The mountains could be dangerous, and we had our share of injuries and altitude sickness along the way. I could tell Jhumpa couldn't quite understand why I was so intrigued by a religion that seemed so quotidian to him. Nonetheless, we did talk, and many weeks later, when we made our way back to Kathmandu, my boyfriend went kayaking, and I went on a day-long meditation retreat with a Tibetan nun. My comparing mind says this should be the point in the story where I dive headlong into Tibetan Buddhism or decide to join a monastery of some kind. But my nature is slow and observant rather than fast and decisive. After the retreat, I picked up a copy of the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying and began to see that my childhood fear was not mine alone, but still I was inclined to manage it on my own. When I returned from the Himalaya, I moved to the Sierra Nevada mountains to help launch a new environmental nonprofit. I had left the boyfriends behind and lived alone in a small wood-heated cabin near the town of Truckee. It was my first real taste of being part of a larger community. We had record snowfalls during the 6 years that I lived there, and this was before cell phones. Can you imagine? And I would not have survived those winters without the support of local friends and neighbors, a sangha of sorts. They helped me to fix frozen plumbing, shovel the snow off my roof, and they taught me the importance of staying in touch with other people. In the middle of January one year, I came down with a horrible flu that left me buried in my little loft bed for 3 days as the snow poured down around me and the power went out. I was saved by friends who noticed my absence in town and dug their way to my place to relight the fire in the wood stove and to make sure I was eating and drinking. It was also in Truckee that I found a few others who were interested in Buddhism. We would drive over the summit to listen to lectures from visiting Tibetan and Vipassana teachers in Nevada City. And we started meeting once a week to meditate together. Usually it was three people, sometimes it was five. For all the idyllic small town life in Truckee, the work at the nonprofit was hard, with many public meetings and long drives. The organization had grown tremendously while I was there, and we were winning national awards, and more foundations were interested in our work. I was leading complex land conservation projects involving scientists, ranchers, community and business groups, as well as politicians, and they did not always see eye to eye. It was my job to keep them engaged and talking to each other. I felt a huge sense of responsibility without much support. And as these feelings grew, I felt the first hints of anxiety and depression. Mornings before setting out to work, I would stand at the mirror, brushing my teeth as tears filled my eyes. I was showing up for everything that was asked of me, but I felt a leaden weight inside. It would not be the last time I would seek therapy to help address a problem of the mind and heart. And still, the world is never one thing. Those years in the mountains, I also began painting and drawing in the evenings. I fell in with a wonderful group of poets who lived in Truckee and the surrounding mountains and desert in Nevada. And it was also during this time that that I met the love of my life, Richard. I was looking for free legal advice on a project, and he was looking for more environmental work in the Sierra Nevada. It was a match made in heaven. I love you. Eventually, I transitioned to part-time work so I could attend art school. One of my instructors also taught plein air painting class that met every Wednesday to paint outside in the wilds of Marin. I had moved to San Francisco at this point. One of my fellow students was our own Natalie Davidson from the Sangha, though it would be years before we reconnected at Everyday Zen. Richard and I attended Vipassana teachings and retreats at Spirit Rock and in the city. And thanks to these teachings, I could appreciate the waves of thought that moved through my awareness. But something was still missing. I had not yet touched the darker, cooler water beneath my floating legs, the sheer terror of death and the unknowability of what a human life was for. Some part of me knew that I could not figure this death thing out on my own. I needed a deeper relationship with a teacher and a more regular practice with a sangha. It was a strange time in other ways too. I felt very adrift, without the identity that once supported my illusion of standing in the world. I was no longer recognized for my full-time leadership on conservation projects. I was working part-time, helping out on other things. At the same time, I was struggling to find my voice as an artist. Unable to secure an identity in the world, the one thing the self is constantly craving, I became isolated and depressed. I thought of leaving my marriage, and on more than one occasion, I thought of just leaving, period. My isolation was also due to a feeling of not being worthy of needing help. Compared to all the world's problems, mine seemed rather benign. I had food and shelter and education and medicine, and here I was miserable with my lot in life. Though my parents spanked us on occasion, I was never abused as a child. I never suffered the trauma of war or the death of a child or racial discrimination in my own country. I never witnessed friends and family members tortured or shot for their beliefs. But as Helen Twerkoff points out in her memoir, Lotus Girl, the Buddha did not describe suffering as a pileup of bad things that happen to you, and whoever's pile is the biggest suffers the most. He had defined suffering in terms of misperception and ignorance. And in his understanding, we don't get to blame anyone, including ourselves. We don't get to blame anyone, including ourselves. It took me a long time to figure that out. Two things during this dark time changed the course of my life. One was finding art mentors, and the other was serving as a volunteer at the Zen Hospice Project. I found my art mentors quite by accident. A couple artists in the studio building where I had worked, and it was my first studio, studied with an artist duo based in Italy, Rose and Claire. They actually go by the artist name Rose and Claire. They offered postgraduate workshops to former students, and I was invited by a friend to attend a rare 3-day class they were offering in Berkeley. The subject was art and the everyday, a theme I'm still working with. Little did I know that as followers of Thich Nhat Hanh, Rose and Claire were on the cusp of bringing together a group of artists to study and practice at the intersection of spirituality and contemporary art. They remained deeply interested in the spiritual legacy of art and art history. It was a gift to be offered this opportunity during a great period of uncertainty in my life. Bodhisattvas everywhere. But when they invited me to join them for the first of these workshops in Florence that same year in June, I balked. I couldn't imagine traveling to Italy, a place I'd never been to study for more than 2 weeks with a group of strangers. Not even my colleagues from my studio building in San Francisco would be there. Fortunately, my mentor at hospice told me I was insane not to go. I thank Eric to this day for changing my mind. As Normand explained to us last week, there really are Buddhas and Bodhisattvas everywhere helping us along. Around that same time, I started to volunteer at the Zen Hospice Project, and I served every Monday afternoon on the same four-hour shift for about 7 years. As was the protocol then, my shift was bookended by two shift change meetings where volunteers shared their experience serving residents at Laguna Honda Hospital, a public hospital in San Francisco. And as I mentioned a few weeks ago in my other talk, Zen Hospice taught principles about showing up for each encounter at the bedside. Among other things, we were taught to sit, breathe, and listen before responding. This simple approach to presence fundamentally changed my sense of what was possible in a room and in the world. I was finally in a place where death was held as a natural expression of life. And it was held with open hands, many open hands, not just my own. As my hospice mentor, Eric, reminded me, as he himself lay dying last year, each of us has our own portion of any experience. It's not my job to figure everything out, as my isolated self used to scold me into believing. One night at a shift change meeting, after we had shared our updates, a volunteer from the evening shift spoke up and described her delight at having found a Zen Sangha that really inspired her. The Sangha was Everyday Zen, and the volunteer was Laura Stillman. Inspired by her enthusiasm, I asked if I could go with her to one of the Wednesday evening seminars in Marin. At that time, we were meeting in Corte Madera, I think. Ultimately, Laura helped me sew this rakusu. Thank you, Laura. In my experience, it wasn't until I had some perspective on these early fears and dark habits of mind that I could truly begin Zen practice. And even then, a lot of my zazen, particularly on sesshin, was drenched in silent tears. It didn't matter that I could explain my early wounds or that I knew death was a natural process. I wasn't depressed, but there was a deep sadness that only zazen was able to touch. I remember telling Norman and Dokusan on more than one occasion that it was no longer my sadness, just the sadness of the world. And I worried that it would never end, that it would overwhelm me. But over time, things calmed down. A tender steadiness began to emerge, a steadiness that I turned to again and again as new and uncharted experiences like this one arise. I find myself taking deep refuge in Ashvaghosha's words in The Awakening of Faith, that ignorance has no beginning, but it does have an end. It's been 57 years since that night in 1969 when my parents tried to comfort their wildly upset 5-year-old daughter about the fact that we all die. They did their very best then, and they have been doing it ever since. It's been 57 years since Suzuki Roshi lectured to his students in San Francisco to reflect on yourself, polish yourself, and as much as you can, get rid of selfish ideas. My parents' deaths are closer than they have ever been to me. My mother enters hospice this week. But their dying is not the all-encompassing darkness of my 5-year-old imagination. Sure, my anxiety and sadness set up shop now and again, but I'm no longer consumed by those thoughts and emotions the way I was, or at least not for very long. I did a lot of crying in my zazen yesterday. I'm no longer treading water, though, in a vast, isolating ocean. Instead, I'm beginning to taste the endless flow of change and awareness and love that is central to our living and our dying. This lets me take in the smells and sounds of the aging body, the small hurts of loving and being pushed away, the ache of physical distance between family members, and the love and gratitude for my parents and siblings, and really to all of you who have made my life possible. All of you who continue to help me become myself. It is for you that I continue to practice. Because in Suzuki Roshi's words, I am perfect just as I am, and I could use a little improvement. Thank you. Be